And we are back with another edition of the Daily Dots. Thank you for joining us. And I am joined, as always, almost always, by the Brain Trust, Mr. Chase Taylor. Now, we're doing this one a little bit different. I've been on phone calls, but not quite end of day yet.
We're about a half hour before the close as we kick off here, just so everyone knows.
Okay.
So if a meteor hits, we didn't cover it. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it also, yeah, that may not be bad news. I know there's some people that are hoping for a meteor to vote for in the next election. I know everybody's seen that. It just caught me the other day, you know, a giant meteor in 2024. Yeah. And I was like, that's pretty funny.
Or the guy that in Texas that changed his name to literally anybody else.
Yeah. And he's running, right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I know. He's got a very compelling campaign.
It's true.
anyway, so S&P down 22 bips, Dow down 25 bips. NASDAQ down 12 bips, pretty flat.
Everything's pretty flat at the moment.
Anything of note, I where are we at with NVIDIA? NVIDIA was looking pretty dicey earlier in the day. I'm sure it's gotten right back above that support level.
It's still down 2.9%, so I still think it's below some important levels. I would think the 50-day moving average, though, at 808 is you know, important. But for me, it's below some important horizontal and kind of like diagonal levels, the most important being horizontal around like 865 to me. Is the fact that it's below that to me matters. So there are still some things looking kind of soft, but they haven't like broken. Super Micro, which has been sort of the small cap supreme leader of this cycle, is like right at its 50-day and some big time horizontal support, like right around 900 too. So like you have a lot of, you just have a lot of different stocks that have been a big deal for the last 6 months suddenly teetering on what look, you know, could be at least a bigger pullback than they've had in a long time.
Yeah.
And I would say notably that we're flat, and now this makes sense because you're going into CPI day, but spot volatility is up like 1.8% carrying a 15 handle. Despite the fact that we're flat, but that's because everyone's hedging up for tomorrow.
You know, I think everybody knows how stretched valuations are, especially in tech land. It does feel, I mean, look, there's some charts that look good. I think Google looks good. It just feels like the majority of that stuff. And NVIDIA is obviously the lead dog in that whole deal, but it's kind of hard to build any more enthusiasm in that stock price.
I mean, that's true, but I would have said that 50, 100, 150% ago.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah.
So I guess it can.
Well, hold on.
I think it's the only tree that can grow to the sky.
Not on a profitable basis. I mean, 150% away, when you looked at the earnings that were dropping to the bottom line in this marketplace, I would have thought it should go higher than that. When you see the profits again in this marketplace, you and I have talked about NVIDIA a ton. I think people are making a lot of really crazy assumptions that those margins are going to hold over
the
time.
The long term assumptions are kind of nuts.
Yeah, they're nuts. I mean, nobody holds 55% margins over an extended period of time, right? You're already seeing news.
And not to mention market share and
Intel coming out with a new chip that looks like it's significantly better than their.
And I think that's part of the problem for NVIDIA suddenly is the fact that Intel's doing well.
Yeah, and I just think living up to just, you know, again, it's nothing against NVIDIA, but we've got to look at it in terms of stock, you know, owners of stock and equity holders of a company. It's just hard to envision a scenario where more good news is going to be. And I feel like I think that's also what's happening to Apple. You know, I mean, you've got a company that's X growth that, I mean, you know, it was interesting. I've been bashing on Apple for a while. It was interesting to read through a list of, you know, like just tries and misses on their part. They you know, they're kind of starting to feel like Steve Ballmer Microsoft a little bit.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's just stagnant.
Yeah, just stagnant, late to the party with new tech. Their phones have fallen abysmally behind. I mean, it really is amazing. And I know everybody's on the Apple bandwagon. Go use a new Samsung phone. It's not even close. It's just not. But I mean, they do have titanium.
Yeah.
No, but I just, and I don't think
face computers.
Yeah.
How are you going to compete with that?
And I just think, you know, now if the Fed cuts, you know, I could see, you know, I could see that unleashing another wave of bullishness to the upside.
To me, their problem is China. It's a big problem from a supply chain perspective, but more importantly, from a demand perspective. Just like same as Tesla, like the two weakest Mag 7 names lately both have the same problem. A lot of competition in China.
Yeah.
Not to mention, you know, the government elbowing them out, you know, in addition to like genuine competition.
Yeah. For the last several years, Apple, obviously for a longer period of time, but the only fear they had out of China was just a general economic slowdown, right? Because the baked in assumption has always been, you know, hey, better Chinese economy does, better our numbers are going to be there. That's no longer the case for Tesla. That's no longer the case for Apple.
Exactly.
It just seems to me like a lot of big bellwethers are very, very stretched here in terms of, you know, I mean, whether you're looking at their valuation range, you're looking at growth numbers, it's just like you're looking around going, we got to find a new reason to party here.
Right.
You know, do you agree with that?
Yeah. And I think that's why the market has kind of has moved on and picked out some other sectors and subsectors to go play in, because this stuff it's got a lot in the price, you know. And if you go look at how unbelievably hot the momentum factor has been, then you go look at momentum holdings, well, it's all this stuff. So like it would make sense for, I think you could even have, you know, 2, 3, 4, or 10, 20 great quarters, you know, on a pure fundamental basis for some of these Mag 7 companies. And then you look up and the stock hasn't done anything.
Yeah.
Just as like a give back for some of the froth that they've, you know, collected in flows and investors buying.
It's also interesting to me, and this is always the case in investing, but it's always interesting to me too, how Reddit, well, especially after, look, I guess after this run that we've had, 15-year biggest bull market of all time, it doesn't surprise me that people think the trees can grow to the sky. But you always reach these points where, you know, there's just this bulletproof feeling like, you know, this can't go, you know, there's no way this thing can't slow down or whatever. And I feel like you have a lot of those narratives right now actually colliding, not with fears that they're going to slow down, right? But like colliding with reality that is completely opposed to the narrative that's driven the stock, right? Like, I mean, think of the narratives for Tesla that have just been taken out back and assassinated one by one, right? Unlimited demand. Best margins in the business, right? I mean, one by one, full self-driving, and I thought it was very telling.
Robotaxis.
That he starts pumping robotaxis the day that news comes out.
And most, like the stock was really teetering on a pretty big breakdown when he came out with that. Just like Apple, I mean, so Apple's teetering at the very moment. It keeps dancing on a very problematic line, like so many of these things are. Like
what's that line? 168?
168 and a half-ish.
Yeah.
And this is 1, 2, 3. This is like, today's like the fifth day we've touched it and bounced off of it. So if that thing gives, you're in trouble. But even Apple, like one of the days they were on this line and looking like they might break down, they came out with some AI headline. Like it's almost like these folks have like a technical analyst to say, oh, it's about to get weird for you. You should probably drop a headline.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then you're getting the obligatory end of day pump here. NASDAQ and S&P just flip positive.
Small's most positive now. Spot VIX still green despite it, although from a VIX futures have gone down. So we talked a little bit about this, but one area that I think is becoming a little susceptible to problems and is asleep at the switch on the fact that it might have some problems is regional banks again.
Yeah.
If you get a hot inflation print tomorrow and the Fed's like, all right, look, maybe we'll cut in Q4, but that's it. And that requires like a ton of good things to happen between now and Q4. Then to me, like regionals have to look around and go, well, then that's a problem for us.
If the Fed says that, I don't understand how you get the 10-year. If they say that tomorrow and that's what comes out, I would think, my guess is the 10-year will be back at 5 inside of a month, if not sooner.
You would think it should be. I do think, so of note, so we have the March print coming up for CPI. March, April, May all have reasonably decent comps. So you can have, unless the month over month number is huge on those, like year over year inflation is going to stay pretty flat. But June, July, August, all of a sudden that flips where the comps get really difficult, and it doesn't take much for inflation to just go juiced like really high. So they better get some cool prints in the next 3 months and then use them to cut, because I think they'll lose the narrative completely on the data come June, July, August, just based on the base effects, which you would think they would look through that, but I've found that they're not very good at looking through base effects.
Well, and the setup isn't that great either, because I wouldn't expect housing prices to give much between then and now. And then in addition, I don't think the oil price is going to be similar to where it was last summer either.
Exactly. So it's tough for them. Now, because of the weird way that we collect housing data and the way it lags unbelievably, you know, maybe that can keep coming down and kind of bail them out on some of the other stuff. But I mean, at the end of the day, if services outside of housing stays pretty sticky and pretty high, like all bets are off, like the month over month prints are going to be, even if housing's bad, like the month over month prints, just based on those services numbers, will be high enough where that year over year number doesn't look great come June, July, August. And I think it'll be enough to like, it at a minimum would make them look like they don't care about inflation if they cut.
Services, and I could be wrong on this, but I would think that services would probably be the sector or the part of the economy that was the most positively correlated to asset prices.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, yes.
Yeah.
You think about like leisure, hospitality, like all the money people are spending, you know, with reckless abandon, very much so.
Yeah.
That's why, like, like manufacturing has bottomed and has picked up a lot, and that is very notable. But the fact that like the services PMIs have been kind of weak lately, to me, like that definitely matters. Like if that keeps happening, you can have more of a slowdown than people that don't really pay attention to those things, you know, would be expecting.
Yeah, I don't really. I mean, we're just not seeing any evidence of a slowdown at present.
I mean, the services PMIs for like ISM and like those have been kind of, they're not horrible, but like they've been weak, and the employment component of them has been weak. Oh, speaking of, let's talk about the day to day, which was only NFIB small business stuff. Really just confirms what we know. Small businesses are struggling. Like we've known that for 2 years, 3 years. But notably inside of it, you're starting to see some inflationary pressures pick back up. Mm. The prices they think they'll be charging, you know, 3 months out, all starting to curl back up and move higher. They list out all the things that are like the biggest problems in order, and their biggest problem for a while there had been inflation, then it became the second biggest problem. It's back to being the biggest problem, and that's like curled higher. So you go inside of that, and it looks very stagflationary for small businesses where they're not doing well, their sales aren't good, like all that kind of stuff. But when they look at prices, they're like, oh yeah, like that's going higher.
Mm. Yeah. Which that's another thing that'll be interesting to watch too, is one of my fears is that this whole inflationary regime that we're in, I would expect that it would only accelerate this whole sector consolidation that we've seen here in the United States for the last 20, 25 years. Right. Just meaning that, you know, the more expensive things get, the more advantages there is to be in a multinational.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're well run, obviously it assumes that you're well run.
Well run depends on where your markets are and how those places are doing, but.
Yep. So then what else do we have teed up for the week? I will say, flip over to a metals update. I don't want to get too bulled up on this. I just think everybody should know by now, we got to keep our heads on a swivel. God darn, gold just looks strong.
Yeah. And it really seems like overnight, every time, you know, the Asia trading pushes you higher, and then it almost feels like American trading tries to like
stamp it down,
pull it back down, and like it usually does. And then, but when you look at the close every day, it's like, well, you got most of that back.
Yeah.
So it has been very strong, and you're still seeing headlines coming out where people are like, we don't understand why this is happening. Like all of our gold models say it shouldn't be doing this instead.
We were talking about that in our investment meeting this morning. And I think it bears repeating. I think that this is a positive sign if you're a commodity bull. And if you guys, if for the listeners out there, if you'll know what I'm saying, if you just think about it, I'm sure you've all experienced this. It is incredible to me that in an inflationary environment like this, everybody talks about all the things that are impacted and everybody expects it. And then oil gets above 80 and everybody's like, oh, oil's getting up into the danger zone again, or copper's at $4. And it's just this incredulity, right, surrounding these prices. And you look at them and go, like we were joking around, I'm like, guys, I just paid $1.99, or I just paid $4.99 for a double cheeseburger at McDonald's. Right, go look at what that, I mean, yeah. You know, yeah, at $80-$85 oil, no six.
The oil to burger ratio would be a great chart.
It's exploded, right? I mean, and it's just so funny that everybody, whenever a commodity pops, everybody's like, what in the world is this going up for? And you're like, it's the same reason everything else is going up.
Like literally anything, yeah.
Right, compared to anything else going up. Like Marcos, I thought, made a really good point today. He's like, isn't that wild that you can get a pound of copper? And just have a pound of copper sitting there in this environment for $4. You can get a pound of copper for the same price you get a double cheeseburger.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
10 pounds of copper for, you know, a meal for two people at almost anywhere.
That's crazy. And it's in, and it, but I do love the incredulity surrounding it though. Like how people, oh, that's so expensive. Like as fat as this pitch looks at this moment, there's nobody on the trade.
Except for, except for Asians. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a few.
They're the ones buying it up while we sell it to them for some reason.
Yeah. I just, to me, it feels like that classic moment that Buffett talks about where you're selling what you're about to need.
Yeah.
To keep what you should be selling. Right. It just feels like that moment. And it's, I think it's really interesting that the the Asians are picking up on that, and nobody seems to be. And guys, that was the other thing we were talking about too. If you hear any talk about the gold trade being overextended or too many people, it's just not the case. It's just not. I mean, there's nothing there. We were going through pretty much looking at every part of it today. There's no part of this trade that's stretched or overloaded or.
Yeah. Short term technically overbought, and like futures people get long. Sure. But like, other than that, like retail is selling in the US for sure. Like, so just sentiment wise, it's not frothy.
No.
At least in America. Now they're stepping over each other in Japan and China to buy more, but of course they are.
When we talk about selling here in the US, are we talking about legitimate transfers of gold ownership, or are we talking about people shorting it?
Selling. So I would say from a physical perspective, we know that the dealers, the brokers are getting flooded with people trying to sell their bullion to the dealers for cash. So my dad is a good example where he has most of his retirement in precious metals IRA. And obviously he has to take a minimum distribution every year, but at other times, like he'll take more off the table when the price is right. So right now the price is right. So he's probably one of these people that's like calling up his broker. I'm like, cool. Like give me a quote for me to sell blank ounces to you. You know, just, we get a big spike and all these people that hold it are like, oh, that seems like a good time to give some away.
For those that might think it's odd that Chase's dad doesn't have his money at Bulwark, let me just give you an insight into managing people's money and crossing with family, right? There's a rule here, right? Or at least that we have it, which is we don't ever pitch family or friends. They come to us. That's one thing. But I always think that's funny where people always ask me, well, so-and-so doesn't have their money managed by you? And I go, no. They're like, well, why wouldn't they just come to you? And I go, well, probably because I haven't gone to them, you know?
Yeah, he's an interesting story. So he worked at a nuclear plant the last like 20 years of his working career. And in 2007 decided to take all his money out of the market. So he just moved all his money into cash, essentially. Market collapse. And all of his friends at the nuclear plant are like, what are you doing? Like, this is insane.
Yeah.
And then the market crashes. And oh wait, now they all think my dad is like some soothsayer. Like a seer, yeah, which is great. Except, you know, didn't redeploy it. So, for 3 different reasons, just in that one example, like he just doesn't really like the stock market.
Yeah,
not a fan. Doesn't really trust it.
Yeah,
which is why, you know, he has a lot of his remaining net worth. And he always held a lot of real estate, but in precious metals, and I mean, he's about to be 81, so like he doesn't really have the runway left to even worry about, you know, being in the equity market anyway.
Yeah, no, I know. I get it. I just thought it was funny. Like the perception of if you manage money, and you know, I think there's so many perceptions around it, and then the reality of it is always different. Like in our business, it's not abnormal to hear that you don't manage a family member's money. You know what I mean?
To me, it's weird if you don't manage your own, but I think the conflict of not of interest, but of good relationships with family and friends makes it a good reason to not do it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's
it's complicated. There's no reason to bring that complication in.
No. And there's no, it's never fun to be sitting at a family dinner and have some relatives start grilling you about why such and such went down. You're just, it's really quick to you reach that point really fast. If you're like, you know what? This isn't worth it. You should go somewhere else.
We were cool before this.
Yeah. Well, the other hard thing too, and this is dealing with any retail money, but especially family, is getting the concept through to them that to outperform means that you will inherently underperform for periods of time.
Yeah.
And that's just a brutal concept.
You don't get both.
No, you don't get both. You just don't. And it's such a hard, in that way, risk management's a tough one too. Because if you're properly risk managing, you will miss out on upsides and you will have returns that can be pretty uncorrelated at times. And so the perception for people, I can't tell you how many times we've had this conversation where a client thought they were doing so much worse than they were. And when we actually went back and looked at it, right, the clients always pay more attention naturally to missing out on upside than missing out on downside. And so their view of where they're at in relationship to the market gets very skewed. And you actually go back through the numbers, you show them, they're like, oh, because like you've said very many, and I've said it before, but I thought you put it perfectly, is that way too few people understand the math of loss.
Yeah. The drawdown math and how much avoiding drawdowns, how much it truncates like problems for you and helps you compound is like, it is so non-
appreciate it.
Super counterintuitive. Like the math is like weird to the human brain. Mm-hmm. Like, honestly, it's like anything that's non-linear like that, like it just gives you a headache.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things.
And it's even when you do it for a living, not as much recently, but there's several times where something will look off to me and I'll have to go back through and calculate and go, oh, okay, I see what happened there. You know what I mean? It's just, you're right. It just doesn't jive with the way we see it. Okay. You've got some stuff you're dialed up for us though. The Stanley Druckenmiller Almanac. For those of you that don't know, Druckenmiller, in my opinion, is the GOAT.
Same.
Ran over a billion dollar fund for 30 years. Never had a down quarter in his career.
Founded it over 20.
Yeah. And I thought it was like over 30.
That might be right. It depends on where you break it out between
Duquesne and
Soros
and,
time
and Quantum. Exactly. Yeah.
So this is... We've talked so much about fiscal, so I wanted to mention.
No, excuse me. Never had a down year, had two negative quarters.
Yeah,
I think that was it. Yeah.
Absurd.
It's nuts.
So you're talking about the fiscal gap where if you had to raise taxes today to guarantee the benefits that you've already promised seniors, he's talking about like the demographic bubble with all the boomers becoming seniors and us trying to support them with the smaller generation. If you were going to guarantee the benefits you promised, you would have to raise 7.7% of GDP, which means you would have to pay for entitlements you promised in the future. You'd have to raise all taxes 40% forever and cut all spending 36% today forever. And that's probably gotten worse since he wrote this.
Oh, yeah. That was probably 19, wasn't it?
At the same time, another just mind-blowing number, and that is since COVID, household wealth is up like a touch under $50 trillion. That's a tax base that, you know, can be tapped. So in a way, like this absurd asset price inflation, you know, is part of trying to pay for that kind of stuff. So you have to keep that ball in the air, you know, medium long term. Like they can't have asset prices go down 50% and sit there because
that's why the
tax base just gets crushed.
Well, and that's why that's another thing that doesn't make any sense to me. Right, the 2% neutral rate.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah. Well, yeah, like if you're right about that neutral rate, there's no way asset prices stay where they are. You're like that. You know what I'm saying? Like you're going to reverse that problem on yourself. Like If that's what they're trying to do, inflate their way out of it, they better hope the neutral rate isn't two.
Right. Exactly. 100%. And Muhammad Al-Arian came out today and said, like, he said the neutral rate's higher without saying it. He said that 2% with like what the world's doing, what we're trying to like, you know, basically rewire and reindustrialize everything. Like 2% is too restrictive of an inflation rate in that environment. And that's just true. And then the Fed is like, they've told you that without telling you that, that like, they've made it clear, like, yeah. Like 2%, like whatever, like we might get there in 2 or 3 years, but like, they're clearly not worried about that.
Yeah.
Which just tells me like they agree with Muhammad Al-Arian. Like, yeah, like 2% is too restrictive. So we're not trying to get all the way back down there, but we're going to keep talking like we care about it.
So what are we, where are we at? Where are we at on the, I mean, I guess all, you know, at this point, I guess all you do is look at if we're pricing in cuts and, or hikes or whatever the case may be. It seems foolish of me, or to me, it seems foolish to go against the market forecast. Cause I mean, how many times has the Fed gone against the market forecast in the last 30 years?
Oh, like never. Yeah. Like this is not a thing anymore.
So probably just, we're looking at what they're going to do on that side. Just watch what the market's building into the price. So anyway, right now, market's pricing no cuts in the next meeting, right?
Correct. July is now what's priced for next, and we have about 2.6 cuts priced for the rest of the year. So,
all righty.
We'll see.
Well,
we'll find out tomorrow. 0.3 is what everyone expects on inflation. So if it's higher than that, we got a problem. If it's lower than that, everyone will rejoice.
All right. Market's basically where we're at when we started with 10 minutes left of the close. It's basically flat. So anyway, guys, thanks for listening. We got to run. Chase does especially, but we both got to move. Anyway, have a great day. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of The Dots. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember, investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.